are going to go on to United States versus Robert George and Michael Spagnola, which are numbers 10-1430, 10-1433, and 10-1657. And it's Mr. Hill.
Correct.
Hi, Mr. Hill.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Anthony Hill. I represent the appellant, Michael Spagnola. I was thinking about this case over the weekend when I was making a birthday cake, and it kind of brought me back to more of a maybe closing argument, but it reminds me of a cake where it's flat and it's empty in the middle and it's got all kinds of problems in it, and then the government, in an effort to hide that from the jury, I think really in this case took as much icing as they could, covered it up, and made it look all nice and smooth. The first problem, I think, in the foundation of the government's case is the proof, or the lack thereof, of any conspiracy here.
Well, don't the recorded conversations reflect that Mr. Spagnola did, in fact, discuss the robbery with Mr. George on one or more occasions, notwithstanding the fact that the two of them never met jointly with the CI?
I don't think that that is actually in any of the recordings. The government never made any effort to record any telephone conversations between Mr. Spagnola and Mr. George. Obviously, they're half-brothers, so they spoke all the time. There's no dispute about that. But there were no recorded conversations between the two of them. The government makes the inference that there was some discussion of the conspiracy between them, but really I think all that you really have as far as Mr. George's involvement here is that the initial point of contact, Mr. George gave Mr. Spagnola's phone number to the CI and basically said,
well, your
I can't
whole case
help.
Against conspiracy is to try to exculpate George, right?
Well,
that's what your brief was all about George had nothing to do with it. But, and I guess that would eliminate the conspiracy if you could show
that it. That was the foundation of the argument in the trial court. You're absolutely right that in order to have a conspiracy, there has to be two or more non-government agents participating in it, and that without Mr. George's participation, Mr. Spagnola's participation in this plan to rob this non-existent drug stash house is not enough to prove conspiracy. That's the root of the argument. But I think all that you have is this initial referral by George, but then George, I think, pretty clearly takes a step back and says, I don't really want to participate in this myself. There are then some conversations between Mr. George and the CI. There's one conversation where they discuss the robbery and the plan, but Mr. George doesn't really actively participate in any of the planning during that conversation. He basically just sits there at the end. He says okay, and he moves on. There's not a whole lot beyond that that Mr. George does to actually indicate that he's participating or doing anything in the conspiracy other than the other thing, which is something that the government correctly points out, which is he says he has the ability to sell some of the drug proceeds. But when Mr. George is having those conversations, my argument is that the conversations that Mr. George is having with the CI about selling the CI's portions of the proceeds are not part of the broader conspiracy with Mr. Spagnola. It's essentially a side deal between Mr. George.
Well, George recruited Spagnola. He brought him into the deal, right? And then they both separately met with Ringwald and the agent. I mean,
I don't know that I agree that he recruited him.
He told Ringwald to call his brother. But that
was really the extent of it. He said, here's my brother's phone number. You can call him if you want, but I don't want anything to do with it. That's basically what he says on that first conversation. Now, you know, I don't think that that's enough really to establish that he recruited him. He may have made a referral, but I don't think that that's enough to create a conspiracy.
Well, he's telling everybody he's going to show up on the day of the robbery until the end. I mean, he's going along with it for quite a while. Doesn't that show conspiracy?
Well, obviously he does not show up. The government suggested in its brief that he was unable. I think the reality is that he made a decision to go to the park instead, and that he, you know, he clearly withdrew himself from the act of participation. But I think if you look at the complete record in terms of
the... He didn't participate, but he didn't withdraw either, I don't think.
Well, but he may have been saying...
There is a big difference.
There is, and there may, and obviously I don't represent Mr. George, so I'm kind of in a unique perspective here.
Fool me.
Let me ask you something else on this, though. I mean, you didn't even challenge the attempt conviction of Spagnuolo, did you?
No.
So he gets a concurrent sentence on that with a conspiracy, right? Which maybe has some issues about this concurrent sentence doctrine. Mm-hmm. So isn't it kind of... Isn't your argument sort of academic in a way?
Well, to some extent it is, but I think it's also difficult to make an assessment as to how the sentencing hearing might have gone differently if Judge Leinenweber was only looking at a conviction on an attempt as opposed to a conviction on a conspiracy. I mean, obviously I can't suggest definitively that the sentence would have been different, but I think it might have been. This issue with George's being aware of the conspiracy, which I think he was, the other thing that's important to note is that throughout the course of the development of this plan, Mr. Spagnuolo and the agents, and they're talking about needing another guy. And the key factor in my mind as far as whether George was actually going to be that other guy and was an active participant as far as going to participate personally in the robbery is the fact that they never said, we have George, we don't need another guy. They were always looking for another guy. Up to the day of the robbery, up to the day before the robbery, they were always looking for this other guy.
You know, your arguments with respect to the severance are focused primarily on various statements that Mr. George made. And did Mr. Spagnuolo ever ask Judge Leinenweber to exclude those statements on Rule 403 grounds?
They did not do that at the trial court. There was, not specifically, there were suggestions. Obviously, there were multiple motions to sever filed by various lawyers throughout the pretrial proceedings. Some of those motions, there was a suggestion, and during the argument or discussion of some of those motions, there were suggestions that George's statements were going to be prejudicial. Counsel never specifically requested a 403 determination one way or the other or a weighing of that, but I think from my perspective, he made it clear that his problem with the statements was that it was going to be prejudicial, and I think the proper response by the government would have been, it may be prejudicial, but it's more probative than prejudicial, and I think the proper response by the court should have been to weigh that once the prejudice was raised.
But you you are appointed. Trial counsel didn't ask the judge to exclude the statements, right?
He didn't object to this testimony, did he?
Well, I think...
That's what I'm...
Don't want to comment on exactly what was going on with the trial lawyer here, but I think from his perspective, the issue was raised in the motions to sever. The issue, as far as whether the statements were going to be admissible or not, was ruled on pretrial when the judge said that they were all coming in as co-conspirator statements. He didn't object specifically to each one as they came in, but throughout the course of the case, he did make objections and say, move for a mistrial at several points, and he did try to object to the prejudicial impact of the statements. It wasn't always done exactly when the statements were coming in, but I think part of that may have been because, from his perspective, the judge had already ruled that they were coming in, and he felt like he was stuck with them. But I think, there's also, we can move on and talk about that a little bit, I think there's a pretty clear Bruton violation, specifically with the statement that George makes when he's arrested, when he's confronted with the fact that they do have him on tape, and he says, you've got me for conspiracy. I think that's a pretty clear...
Right, but how do we know that it's a conspiracy with Mr. Spagnuolo?
Because there wouldn't be anybody else for there to be a conspiracy with.
Wait a minute, we just were talking about that third person, the fool or whatever he was.
Well, but there were discussions of other third people between Mr. Spagnola and the confidential informant. But as far as the evidence that was presented to the jury, I think it was abundantly clear to the jury that the only four people that were really being targeted by the government.
But doesn't the co-defendant's confession have to facially incriminate him? It has to basically say his name. Isn't that the law in this circuit that for a Bruton violation, it has to be very clear?
Well, and that's the general rule. I think that there is an exception to that, which is when it's apparent to the jury that the other person, even if it's not someone who's specifically named, is the person that's being referenced in the co-defendant's statement, that that's still a Bruton violation. And that's
maybe
what we...
Bruton violations here, but they're probably harmless, aren't they? I mean, there's all kinds of other evidence.
Well, I mean, it's hard to say when the government piles on all of this prejudicial impact evidence against Mr. Spagnola what the impact ultimately was. I mean, they were talking about him, you know, robbing old men, robbing his cousin, you know, doing all of these other things.
I think some of this stuff about his relatives were thieves or something like that.
His uncles and his cousins were drug dealers.
Well,
all of that came into evidence, and I think, you know, it left the jury really with the feeling that Mr. Spagnola was a bad guy, and, you know, whether that's...
Look, Mr. Spagnola himself, you know, is busy soliciting the CI's assistance with one or more robberies, so I really can't see how George's comments prejudiced him.
I won't say I respectfully disagree, but obviously I don't agree with that conclusion. I mean, it's from my perspective, it's really just piling on really unnecessary prejudicial information against Mr. Spagnola, both about his family, about his prior dealings.
Both of their families.
But, you know, that's the key problem here, is that it's really difficult to judge what the degree of prejudice was. I think there's undoubtedly some prejudice that comes in from all of those. I don't think that it was necessary for the government to introduce that evidence. I think it was error when they did. I think the judge could have stepped in and done something about it either pre-trial or during the trial to try to rein in the government, and it just wasn't done here. And that, you can hear from Mr. King on this. The other thing that was troubling to me was the discussion during Mr. Spagnola's cross-examination of the fact that Mr. Spagnola has a drug problem and that he revealed that to someone during a competency evaluation pre-trial. Now, for the life of me, I don't know how that's relevant, but again, it's just one more unnecessary question, one more unnecessary piece of prejudice that was put in the record, that was presented to the jury, and from my perspective, that prejudiced the jury necessarily against him, left them really with no other option than to put this bad guy away. And I think that that's how the jury must have been looking at the case by the time they heard all of this improper evidence. Thank you.
Save some time. Hello, Mr. King.
Good morning. My name is Patrick King. I'm appearing on behalf of the United States. I suggest to the court that a rational...
You know, before you even begin, forgive me, but there is something I want to bring up. Even before you get started, I want to alert you to one point concerning Mr. George's appeal. Is there anyone here that is representing Mr. George other than Mr. Hill over there?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe...
Oh, there are. Okay. Well, you're not going to have to say anything. You know, I'm not going to do that to you. But I do want to just tell you that one topic addressed in the Anders brief is whether the evidence is sufficient to support Mr. George's conviction on the attempt charge. And counsel seem to have assumed that even if the evidence is insufficient, the error would be harmless in view of that consecutive sentence. But I'm not sure that such an error would be harmless. So if if my brothers over here agree, we may be asking you to address the sufficiency question. And if we do, of course, we'll issue an order to that effect, asking the government and Mr. George's attorneys to brief that issue. I just didn't want you all to be caught by surprise if indeed that happens. Okay, I'm sorry.
Your Honor, I think a reasonable jury, a rational jury, could reasonably find, based upon the evidence, that the defendant had agreed and conspired. There was tapes. The defendant brought guns. The defendant made a post-arrest statement in which he admitted that he was there. If the agents had only waited a little longer, they'd have caught him with 30 kilos of cocaine, that he brought guns. The guns were his. He brought them for the purpose of robbing him. He had 15 kilos already sold, although he wouldn't explain it to anyone. The district court, in its order denying the motion for new trial, set forth a summary of the evidence supporting the conspiracy, which it characterized as both ample and overwhelming as to the meeting of the minds by the defendants. A defendant takes no issue with that. With respect to the question of the substantive agreements and whether there was recordings, I believe counsel misspeaks a little. In June 11th, there was a recorded conversation between the defendant, George, with the informant, in which George relates he just got off the phone with the defendant Spagnola, and Spagnola shares the same sentiments, that he needed money, he needed to do this. There's a conversation on June 14th in which George, in the presence of the informant, calls Spagnola and arranges for a meeting, the meeting that was supposed to take place on the 14th. And 3 hours later, there is a meeting on the 14th, which is recorded. There's later recordings of conversations in which you hear one side of the conversation, and you hear George relating what Spagnola has said to him. As far as it goes beyond more recruiting, he takes him to the place, he hooks them up together, he formulates a plan with them. He doesn't withdraw. There's conversations which take place on as late as July 9th, in which the defendant George is asking Spagnola, "Do you have the bullets?" He explains that he was present when the gun was obtained earlier. He reminds Spagnola that the robbery is going to take place the following Thursday, to which Spagnola repeats and is recorded, "Well, then we're going to have to be gunned up." En route to the actual robbery, in which there's an arrest, there's a conversation between Spagnola calling, which a person that the jury could infer to be the defendant, George. En route, there's a conversation that, "I thought you were coming down. Yes, I'll be careful." And he says, he describes that his brother Johnny, they're going to the friend of his brother Johnny's. A description of Johnny's buddy is going to be there. "Bob, stop by my brother's guy's house." A clear bit of evidence that the jury could infer.
Did either defendant ever move to exclude any particular portions of the recorded conversations on the grounds of relevance or prejudice?
No, they didn't, Your Honor. All of the tapes were admitted without objection by the parties. In fairness, prior to the time of the trial, there were agreed redactions between the parties concerning certain aspects of the tapes. And what was left in the tapes was conversations which the parties at the time viewed as conspiratorial conversations, at least in furtherance of the conspiracy. Counsel is only partially correct when he suggests that there was multiple motions for severance. There were, but when you look at the motions for severance, counsel for Spagnola really emphasized his client's position, which is that there was never an agreement, therefore there was never a conspiracy, therefore none of the conversations were co-conspirators' conversations. I think it's most telling in the original motion for severance, the reference is at the end of the specific most of the objections are that there's no agreement or that the objected to conversations occurred before there was an agreement. And at the end of his first motion, he said, "Nor there's serious risk that a joint trial will compromise the Fifth and Sixth Amendment right." The district court properly noted that his passing claim didn't demonstrate a serious risk to a specific trial right. And despite the district court specifically laying that out, in every subsequent motion by the defendant, they never identified a specific conversation to which they were objecting or to how there was error that could have been addressed in the trial court. Most of it addresses conversations prior to an agreement. Every statement that was admitted would have been admitted against the defendant in a trial by himself, where the defendant solicits or checks the bona fides of the CI by inviting the CI to participate in another robbery, which the CI begs off on, or establishing that he is perfectly capable and he has experience, that he likes this sort of thing, this is what he lives for. The exchanging of the bona fides is a proper source for a co-conspirator statement and properly addressed and properly received. As to the prejudicial comments, I believe counsel honed in on conversations that occurred on June 14th. What's important to remember is that hours after the statement by George, the defendant, Spagnola, is inviting him to participate in a robbery. A robbery which doesn't take place, and it's not, despite an assertion that it permeated the record, the defendant was not beaten over the head with other uncharged robberies. He was charged with what he chose to do. With respect to the statement that I have relatives which sell cocaine, that was a statement by George, and it's in the context of he had the ability to dispose of all of the potential kilos of cocaine that were available that day. It was somewhere between 20 or 30, or could have been as many as 100 kilos.
It's all this stuff about the relatives.
None of it was objected to, Your Honor. And
well, was it subject of a ruling before trial? Or?
No, it was not.
What if Mr. Spagnola had moved to exclude, you know, the reference to the crimes committed by the cousins and the uncle? What would have been your argument as to the relevance of that particular remark?
Statement by George as to his the fact that he had the ability to dispose of cocaine?
Okay.
I think it would have been relevant, Your Honor, but even if it had been excluded, it wouldn't have hurt the case. And in light of all the other facts, including the defendant's post-arrest admissions, it would have been harmless. With respect to there's a reference to a cross-examination question concerning the defendant's drug problem in a competency hearing. I believe counsel's confused. The defendant Spagnola did have a competency hearing. There were statements that he made during the course of the competency hearing, most important of which is he didn't see a problem with robbing drug dealers because they weren't entitled to have that in the first place. That was stayed away from. What was asked of the defendant on cross-examination after he denied his post-arrest statement that he intended to possess the cocaine and that he in fact sold the cocaine, he went on to state that I wouldn't even know how to sell 15 kilos of cocaine. He was cross-examined with certain other acts that he had done, including attempting to sell ecstasy to the undercover agent. That's what the record actually supports. If there's no further questions, I think we've addressed all of the issues and I ask the court to affirm the conviction and sentence.
What about the accept clause issue, that argument about the mandatory 5-year consecutive? I mean, there's a Supreme Court case pending now on that. I mean, wouldn't it sort of make sense for us to at least hold this case until the Supreme Court's made that decision? And the judge's statement about that it would impose the same sentence regardless, it seems to me that that's not totally clear. So wouldn't it make sense first to see how the Supreme Court case comes out, and then if it comes out different, maybe some sort of limited remand like they did in Booker when Booker came down, just so the judge could say what he would do. I don't know that this will happen, but if we're trying to be prudent here, shouldn't we wait for Abbott and Gould?
That might be prudent, Your Honor, but I'd also direct your attention at the same time to the court's what I believe is a rather explicit reading, which is that if for any reason it was found that the 60-month sentence couldn't be consecutive, the court rejected the defendant's request that a sentence of 216 months would be appropriate. Remember, of course, he was facing 324 months on the underlying cocaine charges alone. His total sentence was less than the sentencing guidelines called for, and the court specifically said if the 60-month was not allowed to be consecutive, he would consider the sentence below that which was appropriate. And I believe in imposing sentence, one of the determinative factors that the court looked to was the age of the defendant and the fact that the defendant presented a danger, and that by the time the sentence of 276 months would be sufficient, that
does
it would no
say,
longer present a danger.
Does he say it would have been consecutive anyway? He doesn't exactly say
the word
that.
Consecutive. I'm sorry.
That's right. I'm just saying he doesn't say that it would be consecutive anyway, does he?
I think he said 216 months, and then the total was 276, so I think it's inferred that the 924C count would have been consecutive. I don't think it was explicit, but I think that's from the math. For these reasons, I'd ask the court to affirm the conviction and sentence of the defendant.
Thanks, Mr. Key.
Thank you.
Mr. Hill, how much time? 2 minutes. Oh.
As far as the consecutive sentencing, that's all that I'm asking the court to do is wait and see what the Supreme Court says on the issue before you render a final opinion in this case. I think that it's important to do that.
They're both in a way, aren't they?
I believe they had oral argument earlier this month. I'm not sure what the exact status is, but...
No. Mr. Spagnuolo and Mr. George, not the Supreme Court.
I'm sorry. There, well, I'm, I must not...
They're away, as we say.
Yes.
They're elsewhere.
They're, yes, there's no expediency needed from that perspective. If you have any other questions, I think that I've covered most of Mr. King's points in my reply brief as far as citations to the record as to what the facts actually are that the government's relying on. I'm comfortable standing on that unless you have any specific questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to just thank you, Mr. Hill, because you were appointed for the very fine job you did for your client. And I want to thank Mr. Poor, Mr. Schneider, and Ms. Krikow for the fine job they did for their client as well. And I want to thank the government for always doing a fine job for its client. And the case will be taken under advisement, and you can escape from this courtroom.